Time to cancel the cabal. With Stephen Roberts. On peoplesinternetradio.com.
Hello everyone, I'm Stephen Roberts and welcome to Cancel the Cabal on peoplesinternetradio.com, Revolution Radio, and PSN Radio. My special guest today is Wal Thornhill. Wallace William Thornhill, born in Melbourne, Australia, 1942, home Canberra, Australia. Wall has a BS in physics and electronics, Melbourne University, 1964. Before entering university, Wall had been inspired by Emmanuel Velikovsky, iconoclastic best-selling book, Worlds in Collision. It taught him to be skeptical and expert of expert opinions. Wall worked at IBM Australia for 11 years, first as a scientific programmer, then as a systems engineer specializing in operating systems and compilers. Moving to Canberra in 1967, he was IBM systems engineer for the research schools at the Australian National University, which gave him excellent access to libraries, scientists there during the Apollo missions to the moon. The early 70s were spent in the prestigious IBM Systems Development Institute in Canberra, working on government projects, data communications, and application to the first computer graphics systems in Australia for the Bureau of Meteorology. And I'm going to put the full bio that Wallace sent me to in the YouTube video. So I want to say welcome to the show, Wal.
Thanks, Steve.
You're very welcome. I do want to say, just before we get started off again, Wall's personal site on the internet is hollowscience.com. And his other site that he's invested a lot of time into over the years is thunderbolts.info, which I believe also is the Thunderbolts Project. Is that right, Wal?
That's correct, yeah. It's the home of the Thunderbolts Project.
Okay, I guess the first question, what in the world interested you as a young lad over in Australia in sciences?
Well, I think from a very early age, I was interested in astronomy. I had an uncle who was a commando in New Guinea during the Second World War who came home with a field telescope, and he used that to show me the craters on the moon, and that really opened my eyes, so to speak. And at school, I used to memorize astronomical facts and drive the other kids barmy, you know, reciting them to them during the show and tell. But it was at high school where I had a close relationship with the science teachers there, and they loaned me books by Fred Hoyle and other people. But it was my father who actually brought home Worlds in Collision from the Servicemen's Hospital Library. He was an invalid following the war. But he thought, obviously, Worlds in Collision, that would be of interest to me. And it was quite an amazing book for me, because it tied together so many different loose threads of thought, particularly to do with what were the stories that came down to us from the past. What were they trying to tell us? Because they seemed to be desperate to tell us something, and it didn't make necessarily a great deal of sense. But Velikovsky, using what's now known as a forensic technique, where you look at the evidence from a whole lot of unreliable witnesses, and you try and pick out the points of agreement. And from those points of agreement, you can then put together a picture of the crime scene, if you like to call it that. In this case, it was the skies that were witnessed by all ancient peoples around the world, because he didn't restrict his research to one little area on the face of the earth. If what was going on was seen in the sky, obviously it was worth looking at what was going on in the other hemisphere. And that was what convinced me that he'd made a strong case for his arguments. Now, there were two major aspects to the book. One is that he made a very strong case for Venus having been a spectacular archetypal comet within human memory, let's put it that way. Velikovsky made, I think, the mistake of trying to bring all this down into historical times, about 1500 BC, which just couldn't be substantiated. However, work that's been done by scholars who followed Velikovsky's lead have said that it was witnessed in prehistory and was a memory even when the pyramids were built. But getting back to Velikovsky's two good cases, he made the case for Venus having been a comet, a spectacular comet, and also a threatening and dangerous comet within human memory. The other thing was that he threw down a gauntlet to astronomers. He said, if Newton's law is sacrosanct, that is the law of gravity, which is supposed to govern the solar system, then this book is a heresy. Well, the astronomers went into immediate denial and got up in the pulpits and said that Velikovsky's book is a heresy. And the result was a modern-day book burning, because the book was published by the technical book publisher Macmillan, and the scientists in bulk said that if you continue to publish this book, we'll take away our textbooks from you. So Macmillan had a book burning, and the book was transferred to a popular publisher, Doubleday. This is despite the fact that the book, for months running, was on the top of the New York Times bestseller list. That gives you an idea of the pressure that was brought to bear. Now, this idea that Velikovsky, or this gauntlet he threw down, was that electricity and magnetism do play a role in the celestial mechanism, as he put it. In other words, it had a role to play, particularly during times of catastrophe, because the ancients spoke about this strange phenomenon called the thunderbolt of the gods. Now, that was sort of interpreted later by people who had no idea of what was these people were trying to tell us as being frightened of lightning, present-day lightning. But obviously it was much more than that, and Velikovsky went ahead and published a book later called Earth in Upheaval, which gave some idea of the extent of the damage that these thunderbolts of the gods could cause. And of course, here in Australia, the native people here, the Aboriginals, have many, many stories, creation stories, which talk about the rainbow serpent in the sky, which created the waterholes, the mountain ranges, and all of this kind of thing. So you get an idea that there's this tie-in between the same imagery, but it's described in different ways all around the world. So when I was got to university, I was keen to ask all these questions about astronomy and the possibility that what we now believed was wrong. And what I got was either indifference or scientists answering a question that I hadn't asked, but one that they could answer, or there was hostility, and I was surprised by that. I persevered, though. I got through university and began doing a research year in upper atmosphere research, which was about the closest I could get to space, I suppose, in that university at the time. And but partway through that year, I realized that there was no place for a heretic in academia because, you'll get absolutely nowhere. So I left and joined IBM because I enjoyed working with computers and the logic involved. And, of course, logic is very important in science, but did my own independent research ever since. And it's taken a lifetime to come to what I call the big picture, the electric universe. And the key aspect of that is simplification, because nature doesn't do things the hard way. And yet what we see now is that we encourage complication by offering Nobel Prizes for new particles and new forces and any other odd thing that can be given a name. So that's sort of the background of how I got to where I am now.
Very interesting. I don't want to start right off with the conspiracy, but you did happen to mention slightly of the hint of political agenda in the sciences. How early off? How early off in your career did you recognize that?
Well, it became clearer in the early 70s. I left the university in 1964, I think it was. The early 70s in Portland, Oregon, there was a student newspaper published there called Ponce, and they did a special series, 10 issues, on the Velikovsky question. And that raised the whole thing all over again and resulted in, finally, in 1974, in the first international conference on Velikovsky's ideas. And this followed the ambush by the AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, meeting in San Francisco of that year, where it was a complete travesty what they did to Velikovsky. It was really an ambush. But at the meeting, the international meeting on Velikovsky's work, which was the theme was the recent history of the solar system. Now, according to astronomers, of course, the solar system has worked for like clockwork for millions of years, and there is no recent history of anything particular of note. It was at that meeting that I met Velikovsky for the first time. I also met David Talbot, who is my colleague and the engine behind the Thunderbolts project and the Thunderbolts website. But at that stage in 1974, neither of us had more or less gathered our wits sufficiently to see that there was a possibility of joining forces. So it wasn't until 20 years later when David had his own first international conference in Portland, Oregon, and invited me over, that I cornered him and said, we should work together, because I realize that the things that you're showing, these so-called thunderbolts of the gods, are really plasma phenomena, electric discharges in plasma, which I can discuss later. But that was the joining point. These electrical phenomena, the thunderbolts, was the scientific aspect that I was working on, and David was working on the other hand, trying to piece together what it was that the ancients saw and how could you piece that together and make a picture out of it, so, something for me to work on, so to speak. So that's how it that part of it came about.
Why do you think science, for the most part, a lot of science disregards historical mythology?
Well, I think it was a famous poet, philosopher, Muriel Rakeza, who said, the universe is not made of atoms, it's made of stories. And I think that's true. We have, ever since these events in the past, we have made up stories to try and make sense of our place in the universe as far as we can tell. And once those stories become established, it's very hard to shift them because they become beliefs. And when you're trying to change beliefs, you know what that's like. And the other aspect of it is our education systems. Our education systems are designed not to make scientists, but to make automatons, people who know what the roadmap is and how they should follow this roadmap to where we are today. Has been built by people who have often a vested interest in deciding who are the giants whose shoulders we'll stand on, and also they rewrite history. It's not generally known, for instance, that Edwin Hubble, after whom the Hubble constant is named, and also Hubble expansion of the universe, felt that idea that the universe is expanding was the least likely explanation. But students aren't taught that, so they don't even think about it. They say, okay, this is the discovery. I'll just memorize that, and then everything I look at will be interpreted in those terms. Once you do that, you're no longer doing science, because science should always be questioning the things that you assume or people in the past have assumed.
So didn't Hubble die in the first quarter of the 20th century?
First quarter, I'm not quite sure. I think it was probably in the second quarter.
Oh, was it in the second quarter? Okay.
And it was one of his students, actually, or one of the people who worked with him in the later stages of his life, who's shown that there was no expanding universe, there was no Big Bang, so that the whole story of the Big Bang is a concocted story which mirrors the Christian creation story. You know, it begins with a miracle, the Big Bang, and afterwards it's just one miracle after another. There are so many unanswered questions and ad hoc additions to that theory to even make the story make any kind of sense at all, that it's surprising that anyone calls it science.
Yeah, interesting. So what is the main premise of the
main difference?
No. What is the Thunderbolts projects? What is their the main?
Well, goal? Yeah, the Thunderbolts project has given rise to our annual conferences, which are very successful. We've actually begun live streaming in the last couple of years. Which has been a boon for those people who can't get to our conferences, which tend to be held in the middle of summer in Arizona. The other thing is that we encourage people to do their own experiments, and in some cases have provided our own sort of crowdfunding for some of those events. But one of the major successes in recent years is that we have established an experiment to test the electrical model of the sun, and that is currently being carried out in Toronto. In fact, I'll be over there next month to talk with the team. These are fundamental changes in the way we look at our situation in the universe, our cosmology, our big picture. Our big picture is totally different to what we have now. In fact, you could say that the present big picture is just a series of pieces of the puzzle stuck, you know, on a blank board with no connection between them. And this arises out of the way we divide science up into specialties now, with one specialty not being able to talk to the one next door. It's fragmented. It's a broken mirror.
Oh, I see. What do the Thunderbolts, how are they made? I mean, are they made between electrical charges from planetary objects getting too close to each other? Or?
Yes. The electrical engineers have their own cosmology. It's called plasma cosmology. And it's peer-reviewed. It has supercomputer simulations. It has mathematics. It has all the things that people insist on for peer-reviewed science, and I've even got one peer-reviewed article in the plasma sciences literature to do with the electrical nature of the supernova 1987A. Now, in having all of this activity in other disciplines, which my role in all of this has been to do the boundary writing of science and find out where are the breakthroughs really occurring, and often it's where there's a lot of argumentation, a lot of more heat than light being generated. And I pick the people who have used common sense, that's the first criteria, also obeyed the rules of science, evidential work, and then try and piece all those together to produce this big picture. The Thunderbolts come in because the plasma cosmologists deal with the electrical nature of the universe, and they have shown how you form spiral galaxies naturally. That form is a natural electrical discharge form seen in the laboratory at Los Alamos, and also shown earlier by scientists back in the 1930s and 40s. The problem is that astronomers don't do any of that. They're not taught any of that. So the things they see in space are foreign to them. And because science is fragmented, as I said before, the astronomers don't attend plasma cosmologist sessions at the IEEE meetings. And so they are unaware of what it is they're actually looking at. Now, the Thunderbolts group have gone further than the plasma cosmologists and looked at the electrical nature of bodies caught up in these cosmic circuits, and their electrical circuits. And the galaxies are strung out along these wires, if you like, cosmic circuits, like Catherine wheels on a string or on a wire. And the stars within the galaxies trace the current flowing into the center of a galaxy like streetlights following the power poles. And in the center of a galaxy is you have what is known to plasma scientists as a plasmoid, which is the highest concentration of electromagnetic energy that is possible in the laboratory. And of course that's misinterpreted as a gravitational object, and because gravity is 10 to the minus 39 times the electric force, of course you have to imagine incredible mass if all you've got to work with is gravity. In an electric universe, it all works quite normally. You know, the concentration of electromagnetic energy there, according to E equals mc squared, is the same as having an enormous concentration of mass. And all of the strange things that we see going on in the centers of galaxies, like those huge jets that come out occasionally, and black holes are supposed to suck matter in, not spew it out, that's all a natural form of these plasmoids that are observed in the laboratory. So it gives you immediately some sense of the disconnect in science. The specialization is actually killing it.
Killing it.
Yeah, killing science. It
I see. Traditional science tries to insinuate that glacial activity and plate movement activity make the mountains of the world.
But yes, they have no idea.
No.
The electric force is so powerful and overwhelms gravity so easily that the formations on the surfaces of planets and moons and so on can all be explained fundamentally as electrical scarring. Even the craters on the moon are well over 90%, about 95% are circular craters. Now, impacts cannot produce, you know, from any angle, cannot produce those beautifully machined craters. The Apollo astronauts remarked on how pristine they looked. And the reason for that is, A, they're machined electrically, which is just the same sort of thing as used industrially now called electric discharge machining or spark machining. And that's used for very accurate carving of metal surfaces. Now, the Thunderbolts of the gods do just the same thing. They carve the surfaces of planets and moons. And as a result of this information or this idea, it's been possible for me to make predictions well in advance of spacecraft arrivals at various bodies that have been spot on, whereas astronomers have been continually surprised by new discoveries.
Ah, that's interesting also. I think, I don't really know the truth, so I can only speculate, but I have seen evidence out there, and I have heard presentation testimonial that that insinuates our moon might be a man-made object or some sort of a terrestrial-made object, and was placed in our close proximity within the last 30,000 plus years.
Well, certainly there is almost a racial memory of a time before the moon. In The ancient Greeks talked about the Proselenes, that is, the ones who lived before the moon. The history of the Earth is nothing like what we've been told. The story we've been told of the formation of the solar system is another one of these concocted fairy tales that are made based on mathematical speculation. And of course, mathematicians like to have things that they can that aren't discontinuous, so that they can retrocalculate.
They like to put everything in a nice, neat box, don't they?
Exactly, yes, okay. But nature's not like that. It has these discontinuities where suddenly all hell breaks loose, and then afterwards you say, well, what was all that about? The story of the Earth, actually, it went out science fiction, any science fiction movie, and humans witnessed the last chapters of it, and we can piece it together. And there's been books written about it for those who are interested to follow it up. But it challenges every concept we have about our place in the universe. And that's one of the things that I find gets more and more important the older I get. And that is that Velikovsky, towards the end of his life, his last book, I think, was Mankind in Amnesia. And he was worried that because we lived through events where we thought we were about to witness the end of everything for us, it was doomsday for the Earth and for us, we have never recovered from it. It's like a human being suffering a terrible trauma, an event that they just cannot, they don't want to think about. And so the mind shuts that off and you suffer from a kind of amnesia. And this is the subject of his book, of course, but he said it's not just individuals, it was the whole human race. And he said the as a psychiatrist, he was a trained psychiatrist, of course, he said that the problem with that is that the subconscious knows the information. You can't push it down. You may have consciously forgotten it. But the danger is that for somebody who suffered a terrible trauma, which has involved death and destruction, is that there is this tendency to consciously try and relive the events or go through it in some safe way. You know, well, we do it today with all these disaster movies. I mean, you can begin to understand our fascination with dinosaur movies and disaster movies and things from the sky
alien
crashing
movies
into the Earth. Yeah,
a lot of
all
alien
that stuff.
Movies, yeah.
Yeah, and it all can be traced back to this psychosis, really. And he said the worry that he has is that amnesic patients will sometimes try and re-perform, you know, whatever it was happened in the past. And of course, if it was the destruction of the world, then we're in trouble. And if we've got nuclear weapons, which can kind of recreate the kind of destruction of the ancient so-called planetary gods, we're in real trouble. And he said the only way for an amnesiac, in this case the human race, to recover is to be allowed to understand what the events were, and that it's no longer happening, and therefore you don't have to keep repeating this crazy psychotic behavior, our global warfare and things like that. That's a recreation of the destruction of the past. Our destructive attitude towards the planet is not designed for a long-term future in this universe. So this is why I think at the end of the day, the electric universe story is important for our long-term survival, not just our science. That gives you some idea of my passion for this.
Yeah, certainly. I don't believe, well, I can only speculate again, but I would find it hard to believe that anyone or any amount of people that go through some sort of a catastrophic event like that wouldn't have some sort of a physiological effect on them.
Oh, yes. Yes, that's true. Getting back to the moon, you asked about the moon.
Yes.
In the electric universe, and it's only in the last couple of years that I've been able to finally be satisfied that I understand gravity in electrical terms, because it's a force, and the electric universe says that all forces can be understood in terms of just a single force, the electric force. This is quite different to what science has been doing, trying to invent new ones every time something pops up that they don't understand. And in the case of gravity, it turns out that gravity is very much like magnetism. It has a positive and a negative pole, a north and a south pole. Now, this raises a very interesting, all sorts of interesting aspects. And without going into any detail, because it's a little difficult in the time available, it means that we are attracted to the Earth and the Earth's surface like iron filings are to a magnet. Now, that means we don't care whether it's a north or a south pole. The magnet will be attracted equally to either, whichever's closest.
So it's not really the centrifugal force of the spinning that keeps us on the Earth?
Well, if you can treat the Earth like a spherical magnet with one pole facing outwards and the other pole facing inwards, that suddenly raises an interesting possibility, and that is that the Earth has a hollow center, or maybe it's a sphere within a sphere.
And there we get into another conspiracy.
This raises an interesting question, because that means this would be the same for all bodies in the universe.
Yes.
And that means that the same pole is facing outwards on everybody in the universe, so they're all repelling each other. And that then means that gravity, in cosmic terms, is a repulsive force. But, of course, we keep making this same mistake over and over again. We keep looking at things from our own geocentric, little home on Earth as being the center of the universe. And so what we experience on Earth, we then attribute to everything we see in the universe. And that's wrong. And another aspect of this view of gravity is that you can change the gravity of a body by these thunderbolts of the gods, electrical discharges. And that's why dinosaurs were able to live in the past, because they certainly could not even lift themselves off the ground in present-day gravity.
Okay.
It would have to be a third or less of what it is now for them to get off the ground. Also, those giant birds the size of a large glider.
Yes.
They would have snapped their wings, or they just couldn't have flown in present-day conditions. And this is just ignored. I think in Jurassic Park they had the Brontosaurus standing on his hind legs to browse the tops of the trees. That's nonsense. It couldn't have stood on four legs or six or eight legs in present-day gravity. This means also that you have an efficient means of capturing bodies and stabilizing their orbits. Now, Newton's law is completely chaotic. If you have more than two bodies in a system, the whole thing will become chaotic and fly apart in a very short order. A few million years the solar system would last. That's about it. It'll fling all the planets out into space. The electric universe shows that when you enter the electrical realm of a star, and the sun's electrical realm extends way out to the heliosphere, 100 times the diameter or radius of the Earth's orbit, a long way out. Anybody entering that sphere of influence begins to discharge. And a body discharging in space looks like a comet. In fact, that's what a comet is. It's an electrically discharging piece of rock. But if it's planetary-sized or stellar-sized, that discharge is pretty spectacular. But it is still cometary. And the fact that it's losing charge means its gravity is changing, and it's changing in a way that pulls the body in towards the central object, the star or another planet. So this solar system is a blended family of objects that have been captured by the sun over its lifetime. All of the giant outer planets were captured, and the inner planets are just satellites that were stripped off in that process and got lost. In fact, Venus, Earth and Mars were all part of the same system. We all came together, so to speak, and had to adjust our positions in the solar system very quickly. Now, you can't do that with gravity. The whole thing is chaotic. In the beginning, it'll remain chaotic. The electrical system calms it all down, puts things in their orbits. In fact, Venus has the most circular orbit of all planets, and the reason for that is it was the most spectacular comet in human memory. So it was busily adjusting itself into its present orbit. So, this changes everything. The moon was captured by the Earth. In fact, our moon would look quite at home amongst Jupiter's moons. If you were to put it out there, it would look quite at home. But we captured it. And the other aspect of it is too, and this refers back to hollow Earth, one of the experiments that was carried out during the Apollo missions was to put a seismometer on the surface of the moon and then have one of the spacecraft objects orbiting the moon crash into the moon. And they wanted to register the seismic effects. And it completely stunned the planetary scientists, because what happened was, they said, it rang like a bell and it kept on ringing. And they said they had no real answer for it, but the most obvious one was that it was hollow. The moon was hollow.
Yes, and it was also made of metallic.
Oh, I don't know about that. You cannot tell what a body is made from in space, because the gravitational constant only refers to the Earth. Every body has its own big G, so to speak. It's not universal. That was one of these assumptions that was made, which has crippled our understanding of the sun, for instance. This is the thing about the Electric Universe. It covers so much ground that you could spend days talking about it and still be talking about new things.
I also find it interesting that there are, well, like I mentioned, historical stories and certain societies. I think some of the African nations and even some of the Aboriginal, the Australian people, I mentioned earlier that they place our moon coming into our sight within the last 30,000 years.
Their stories are more accurate than our creation stories, sure. A biblical story and so on. Yeah. In fact, all the creation stories are not talking about the creation of the universe. I mean, that's nonsense. There's no one there to witness it. What they're talking about was the events in the sky, because they saw things being developed and changing shape and generating these thunderbolts of the gods. It was like a giant theatrical performance up there. And so their creation stories were all about that. And it makes sense of some of the language too, which makes no sense otherwise, once you understand what it was they were talking about.
I wanted to ask you also, I didn't mention it the other day when we talked last weekend about the about some of the conspiracies I wanted to get into, but there's a English man named David Icke. He's traveled the world, and he has a presentation out there that, I guess there's science out there that says Jupiter was once a sun, and it's now a burnout dwarf sun.
Yes, that's something that has occurred to astronomers as well, that a body like Jupiter could have been a brown dwarf if it was a bit bigger. Now, that is an assumption about how stars work. And as I said earlier, we've got a project looking at the electrical nature of stars, which throws all of the ideas of stellar birth and evolution into the dustbin. The evidence is also pouring in favor of this model. They've discovered that stars are formed along these glowing filaments in cosmic clouds. It's the equivalent of intercloud or intra-cloud lightning on Earth, only this time it's out in deep space. And the stars form like bead lightning, like beads along a string. Now, this was unexpected, because gravity is supposed to pull things in radially, and here we've got long, thin strings with stars forming on it. Now, it's not just stars that form along there, but also planets. And it's after the filament moves on. Now, when I talk about filament, think of those little plasma balls, you know, the glowing filaments snaking around inside. It's that kind of effect in deep space. Those filaments aren't static. They move. And once they've created some stars from the surrounding dust and gas, and that, by the way, is the most effective way of pulling in dust and gas, is a lightning bolt. On Earth, of course, it does it. Very effectively, squeezes the atmosphere, the molecules and so on surrounding, and heats it so that once it's done its job, the whole thing suddenly expands again and you get that terrific clap of thunder. Well, in space, what it leaves behind is a whole bunch of these newly formed bodies, stars and planets, which are moving relative to one another. The plasma physicists who've witnessed this in the laboratory have used the expression scattered like buckshot. Now, this is where the electric capture comes in, because once they've formed, then they have the opportunity to capture nearby objects that are flying past. And so the discovery over the last decade or so of thousands of exoplanetary systems show that this kind of mechanism is the favoured one, because you've got, they've discovered planets orbiting backwards and over the poles and all sorts of crazy arrangements, making our solar system look relatively benign and the odd one out. So the electric model just works at that level. But it also says that any of these large planet-sized objects will become stars on the, in their own right. In fact, the Sun must have a planetary center. Somewhere in there is something much bigger than Jupiter beneath that bright glowing plasma discharge that we call the Sun. And you can tell that there's something cooler inside, because where there are sunspots and that that lightning envelope opens up, it's cooler inside. That's exactly what you'd expect. That's what you see in the laboratory. So where were we going with that? Jupiter. Jupiter, before the Sun captured it, was a brown dwarf star. Now, the word dwarf comes from the standard model of stars. They think they're small because of their light output. And that's not so. A brown dwarf is actually a huge object, because it's the outer rim of their so-called magnetosphere that lights up. And if Jupiter's magnetosphere was to light up today, when it's closest to the Earth, it would appear larger than the Sun in the sky. That gives you an idea. So as a brown dwarf, it would have appeared as large as the Sun. And there's already evidence, observational evidence, to show that red dwarfs are not small. Now, if you can imagine that, then that huge glowing envelope would include all of the inner moons, Io, Europa, Ganymede, and Callisto, and they would be inside a glowing shell and orbiting around this huge planetary body that we call Jupiter. But this glowing shell is the perfect envelope for life to form, because all of those moons would be receiving the same amount of heat and light energy over every square inch of their surface. There'd be no poles, you know, polar ice and all this sort of nonsense.
Wouldn't they also have the same elements?
Yes. The other thing about brown dwarfs is that they their only way of achieving electrical stability, if their environment changes, is to eject matter. So they are continually losing a certain amount of matter. And that matter sometimes can come out in a fairly catastrophic blast, and you get layers of material dumped on the moons. This is why every object that's been examined in space, the surface has been examined relatively closely, is layered. You know, Mars is beautifully layered. There's been some photographs that just came out in the last week which shows this layering. The Earth is layered. The Moon is layered. The comet 67P shows layering. It gives you the image of life, and the surface material for sustaining life is all available from the central object in a brown dwarf star. In fact, the most ancient recollections of the Earth's environment was that it was what they called the purple dawn of creation, where the light was dim, red, slightly purple because there's ultraviolet light and the violet end of the spectrum from the electrical discharge going on, and that water misted down out of the atmosphere continually. It was the perfect environment for the Carboniferous era, when the Earth was just covered from pole to pole in an enormous vegetation.
Do you suspect the other three gas giants were also dwarf suns?
Oh, yes. Yeah. In fact, Saturn was, it's fairly easy, actually, once you learn the technique of forensic investigation of ancient testimony, to figure out that Saturn was our former sun. In fact, the earliest words for the sun, Helios and the soul and so on, the ancient terms were applied to Saturn, not to the sun. And we can actually trace our origin back to that brown dwarf, Proto-Saturn. In fact, I wrote an article when the Cassini mission was due to arrive at Saturn, and I called it the homecoming, and I explained why that was, and the fact that that was our former home, and what that former home was like, and how you could predict the aspects of the Mars, Earth, our atmospheres, Venus, its high temperatures and its strange atmosphere, and also what they would find beneath the clouds of Titan, the biggest moon of Saturn. And I was the only one who got it right. I said the surface would look scarred just like Mars and the Earth. And, of course, that's what they found.
Yes. I've recently seen a documentary on the History Channel that talks about Mars. And they,
yes.
They show, I think it would be a facsimile of what it looks like onto the TV screen, but they don't they don't actually show any photos or anything like that. But there seems to be a very, very large scarring on the surface of Mars. And
oh yes, yeah, the ancients witnessed that. Mars, of course, was the god of war for good reason. That planet was closest to us during some of the spectacular events that occurred. And the discharge between Mars and the Earth looked like a sword at times, or a pillar on which the planet revolved.
Right.
And the ancients described a battle that Mars had with Venus, and the Hordes of Chaos, it was called. All this material that was being stripped off Saturn in the process of its electrical adjustment to the sun's environment was being spat out equatorially. And most of it went to make up Venus, but there was a lot of rubbish flying around, large bodies and that. And Mars was copying the worst of it, because it was closer to Saturn than we were. And so Mars fought the monsters of chaos, and but it got struck by Jupiter's thunderbolt. They call it Jupiter, but it was probably referring. You've got to be very careful about the identification of the modern or the Greek names or so on with the planets involved. But Mars was struck by this cosmic thunderbolt and bore a scar. And the North American Indians call Mars Scarface. And in the Australian Aboriginals also talk about the lightning emanating from these bodies.
What would that look like? What do you think that would have looked like to a human on Earth, the thunderbolts going from planet to planet or from one satellite to a planet?
Yeah, there was a description which was, this is part of the memories that was still around in Greek and Roman times, and a lot of it passed down from the Egyptians. And they said the thunderbolt was like a coal spat from a fire. And that's right, it wouldn't be like a lightning discharge on Earth. It would take the form of one of these plasmoids, and it was sculpted. You see Zeus's thunderbolt. It doesn't look anything like a lightning bolt. It's got a central squeezed part, if you like, and then it's got two almost sort of football flame-shaped ends, and this is typical of a plasmoid kind of shape. So what happens is that a plasmoid flies between the two bodies. In the case of the Valles Marineris, it took me years. I was trying to figure out what exactly would the form of the discharge across the face of Mars have looked like. And I realized when NASA published an image which picked out the scar on Mars and also the features around it, that it curved up and around in the north, and in the opposite hemisphere, from the other end, it curved down and around and back. It was a spiral galaxy. Now, a spiral galaxy is the largest and most beautiful form of a cosmic electric discharge. And here we've seen it imprinted on Mars' face.
Oh, very interesting there, yes. I wanted to digress just a little bit. Well, if I can remember the question now, I had it on tip of my tongue, but I'll go to something else and then I'll go back to that.
I have the same problem with answers.
Oh, well, yeah. I remember what it was now. You mentioned that the Big Bang was not a receding universe. I think you mentioned the universe is not receding at all. Is it just a stationary universe, or is it moving at all?
It was Halton Arp who did the some of the definitive work, observational work, and I mean, he was firmly grounded in observation, not in what do you call it, simulations, which is what everyone seems to do today, and they call it science. And he produced the Atlas of Peculiar Galaxies, and in the process of doing that, he noticed that what are called quasars, these objects, strange bright objects which look like a star but are actually a galactic object, seem to be preferentially found spaced equally on either side of an active galaxy. Now, an active galaxy is one where out of the center of the spiral comes this jet, and it goes in both directions, both outwards, upwards and downwards. And he found the quasars were dotted along these jets, equispaced either side. But when you looked at the quasars, their redshifts were, there was a change, high redshift near the galaxy, lower redshift, lower redshift, lower redshift, and more bright, so that the redshift decreased and its brightness increased the further away you got from the parent galaxy. Now, the other thing he found was that, this is a little extra, that this redshift was quantized. And this gets back to one of the pillars of modern cosmology, quantum mechanics, and it's supposed to operate only at the subatomic level. Here was Halton Arp, the astronomer, showing that no, quantization occurs at the galactic scale. So there's something seriously missing in our understanding of quantum physics as well as astronomy, both ends of the scale. Now, in doing that, he was able to show that high redshift objects are not at the ends of the universe. It's not because they are traveling away from us at close to the speed of light. It is simply because they were recently born. The matter in them is of lower mass than on Earth. Once again, this geocentric idea that you can just extrapolate what we find on Earth and place it out there in deep space and assume everything is okay with your theory. It's not. As it moves further away, it gets brighter and brighter, and the masses of its particles increase in quantized steps, which shows that it's a subatomic phenomenon occurring at a galactic scale. So the electric universe took all of this into account, and also Halton Arp raises all sorts of cosmological issues towards the end of his book, Seeing Red, which I recommend to people to buy and read. It's easy to read. And he pointed out that this means that if these objects aren't at the ends of the universe, the universe is relatively static, and it is almost biological in its overtones. Here we've got a parent galaxy giving birth to children.
Almost biological.
The children slow down. Initially, they're ejected at extremely high velocities, a good fraction of the speed of light. But they gradually grow in brightness, lower redshift, and slow down. In other words, they're gaining in mass. That's what I said, the particles within them are gaining mass with time. And then they go into orbit about their parent. So you end up with these families. And in doing that, you can actually figure out in the local region the difference, family groups. And it also shows that this idea that the Andromeda galaxy is going to crash into the our galaxy, the Milky Way, in a few million years is nonsense. It just means that Andromeda is older than us.
No, yeah, okay. I come across something last week, Wal. I wanted to run it by you. Mm-hmm. Somebody was possibly theorizing that it was not a coincidence that it was a conspiracy that our moon is placed exactly in the correct place. Well, they use the instance of lunar eclipses and solar eclipses.
Yes.
You can't see anything of either of the objects once there is one eclipse, whether it's a lunar or a solar. The moon is not seen and the sun is not seen. That would suggest that there is some perfect placement in there. And the suggestion was also that there is no accident in that.
That raises all kinds of philosophical issues. The very fact that after the breakup of the proto-Saturnian system, as we call it, that the Earth should end up in the Goldilocks zone, yeah, as astronomers call it,
yeah,
where it's conducive to all of the beauty and nature and life that we see on Earth.
Yes.
The fact that that happened is pretty remarkable as well. And now we've got a moon which is up there to give us a lesson in astronomy about the sun. For instance, the fact that we can see the corona, we wouldn't be able to see the corona unless the moon blocked out the sun's light. It does make you wonder about the universe, about the fact that we are witnessing it, our consciousness, what's it all about? It makes us the self-referential part of the universe. What we witness, the universe can learn from. So, and maybe the universe has sufficient information and intelligence, since it can also create life from the matter in the universe, that it can also look after us. It raises all sorts of interesting philosophical issues.
Yes, yes. I think other shows we are going to have to get into so many other aspects in the conspiratorial. We're coming up on just maybe a couple minutes left here, Wal. But I wanted to say there's an American comedian. His name is George Carlin. He died not too long ago.
I've seen him
in the last decade. He's died. I think in his last 5 years or so, he really didn't give a rip anymore. He just started saying what he thought. He became a anarchist, and he became an activist. And one of the things he said, actually two of them, first quote, it goes something like, they don't really want people to be smart anymore. They just want people to be smart enough to be able to run their machinery, find their file their papers, and do their slavery work for them.
You certainly get that impression. Our education system is not designed to create scientists, as I said. The way people are taught so-called facts and then are graded on their ability to remember those facts and to just build on them but not to think about them.
Yes.
I think is... yeah, critical thinking is one of the things that I enjoyed at school. I don't know if it's even taught anymore.
It's not.
That is to analyze a polemic or some article where somebody's trying to shove some idea down your throat, and you analyze all the tricks they're using to try and get you to believe in what they're saying. And you realize that our education system is no better.
Yeah, it's basically not taught in the... in the junior years of school and the high school years, and I believe it might be an elective in college, if I'm not mistaken. It
shouldn't be an elective. And also the other thing is, it should be taught in terms of the history of science.
Yes.
If you go back and look, and this is one of the things that I do a lot of, because I've actually identified a whole string of pioneers of the electric universe. They go back to even Newton and Faraday, would you believe?
Sure.
They all had ideas at the time that electricity would be found to be the answer, but that was lost in the craziness that ensued after the First World War and when government started funding science.
Yeah.
Prior to that, all of the big breakthroughs were made by people, often outsiders in the discipline, who brought to the field a beginner's mind. And that's what you need. So when you go back and look at the history, it is fascinating, and you realize that a lot of the big decisions were made on the show of hands or political power or some other show business type influence.
Yes, yes. And the other quote he had was, well, it wasn't actually a quote, it was actually a statement. He said, first, my first rule of thumb is I believe nothing that government tells me. And I've somewhat adopted that philosophy myself.
Well, I think that's a good start. Be very skeptical.
Skeptical, yeah. There are far too many lies that have been rebuked and debunked. Far too many of their stories have been just debunked and rebuked.
Yeah. The other thing is the media is at fault here too, because science has become show business, and it's all virtual reality created on computer screens. So all you get reflected back from a computer screen is the nonsense you put in.
Certainly.
Science is much more interesting when you broaden it out and involve everyone. I've often said I should write the Home Handyman's Guide to the Universe.
Yeah. Science, people are supposed to be scrutinized. They're supposed to be questioned, aren't they?
Yes, yes.
That's the only... philosophical, that's the only way to debate and discuss, actually.
It's the only way to make progress.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. So I thank you very much for coming on today, Walt.
No, thanks, Steve, for the invitation.
All right.
Time to cancel the cabal. With Stephen Roberts. On peoplesinternetradio.com.